Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. My interview today is with Roger Thurow. He is a former, I guess he's still a journalist. He's a former journalist with the Wall Street Journal. He spent 30 years with them and 20 years as foreign correspondent. So we talk a great deal about a whole lot of things. But most importantly, we talk about his new book, The First 1,000 Days. And it's really all about malnutrition. And malnutrition globally, and we talk about these four mothers, these four families that Roger follows, who, that create this narrative thread to the cost behind malnutrition and some of the interconnected implications of it all and the unintended consequences. As you said, we talk about foreign policy, and we talk about his mantra, which is outrage and inspire, which I think you're going to find really interesting. We talk about agricultural development. And we talk about hunger in the 21st century. And we talk about something called the gray matter infrastructure. I mean, how cool is that? And we talk about the cost of or the costs of inaction. You're going to enjoy this conversation. Roger, in his own words, would say he gets carried away, and it's great, and it's energetic, and there's passion and commitment, and I think you're going to love every minute of it. So please tune in for the full interview with Roger Thurow coming right up. DavidPeckLive.com for more information about my speaking and my writing and my podcasting, but also Rabble.ca for a whole slew of other podcasts that you can find out more about on Rabble.ca. Roger Thurow coming right up. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, Roger Thurow. He's from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He's a senior fellow there. He's an expert of a particular sort and a former journalist with the Wall Street Journal. Roger, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Delighted.
So, I mean, there's so many places we could start. 30 years with Wall Street Journal, is that right?
Yes, 30 years. Whoever thought I would stay at one place for such a long time. But of that time, 20 of those years, I was overseas as a foreign correspondent. So every 4, 5, 6 years or so was off to a new place, new stories, new adventures. And so I think that kept it all very fresh.
So before we start talking about your book, because I definitely want to do that. I love these kinds of questions. You know, these sort of, what's the one lesson you took away? I mean, what do you take away from 30 years overseas? I mean, obviously it was back and forth by the sounds of it, but what do you take away and sort of build? I don't know, a new perspective, a different worldview.
Yeah, I think it was fascinating, kind of. So the time that I first went overseas in 1982, to Bonn, West Germany, when there still was a West Germany. And then so I was there for 4 years, and that was during the time of the Cold War. Was raging, and kind of all the aspects with that. Then I was in South Africa for about 4.5, 5 years from then 86 to 91, and that was the last gas brutal years of apartheid and, you know, increasing opposition, increasing repression. Then Mandela was released while I was there, was in Cape Town that day, and then there for a year while he was on the international and national stage. And then I think, you know, what one sees is you get an appreciation for the impact of, say, particularly from my perspective as an American, the impact of American foreign policy and things that are said that, you know, it might be, say, the unintended consequences or kind of the effect both, you know, kind of economically that it can have, but then also kind of on the attitudes that people then form towards the United States, you know, based on things. For instance, one of the times that when I was in Bonn, the defense secretary in the U.S., I think it was Caspar Weinberger, perhaps, Reagan administration, and he was saying something about the prospect of a winnable nuclear war, meant that, you know, I'm sitting in West Germany at the time, and the Germans heard that, and they, you know, their hair was fairly standing on end collectively, because a winnable nuclear war would have meant that kind of all the nuclear missiles landed on Germany, both East Germany and West Germany, and because that's where, you know, kind of a lot of them they were targeted at the time, figuring if there's going to be another conventional war. During that time, well, it probably would have been on that territory, and so the French weapons were aimed at Germany. You know, some of the Soviet weapons would have been too, and so you know, or East Germany and West Germany, and so you kind of just see how a statement like that, you know, from the consumption of the American, you know, population or foreign policy apparatus, that there's a debate about that, a wageable and winnable nuclear war. But if you're sitting over there, it's like, oh, geez, that would mean basically the end of us. So I don't know who's
well, and
would be winnable from their perspective.
Define winnable.
Right, yeah, precisely. Yeah, what are you left with after that?
Wow, I mean, from anybody's perspective, frankly, you know?
Exactly.
You know?
Right.
Wow, just... So, how did... Right. I guess the question... So many questions popped to mind, but how have we survived? You know? How have we managed?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing that you had. I mean, and then it was, you know, then there was basically kind of the big bang, not kind of the nuclear bang that we were all, you know, fearing, or that the whole, you know, kind of Cold War apparatus was set about, but the big bang of history that happened,
yeah.
You know, all basically within a 3 or 4 month period at that time, with the fall of the Berlin Wall in November of 89. And then, so I was, you know, kind of familiar with that story, having covered Germany for so long. And then the release of Mandela then in February of 1990. So in that time frame between, say, that November and early February, two things that, you know, most of us living at the time would have said, well, those things will never happen.
Right.
Fall of the Berlin Wall, essentially the end of communism in Europe, and the release of Nelson Mandela and the end of apartheid. It was like, now those things won't happen. But they did, within that short period of time. And then you know, then you look at kind of all the forces that have been released in the world since then. You know, it's been kind of this, I think somebody wrote that, well, it was the end of history.
Right.
But obviously that's nonsense.
It was Fukuyama, I believe.
Fukuyama, right. And then... all this history that has come since then, because then after being based in South Africa for those almost 5 years, then I moved to Vienna, always still with the Wall Street Journal, and in Vienna, so, and then in kind of early 91 or so, or mid 91, was going to write about then moving there to basically cover the burgeoning democracy and capitalism in Eastern Europe. And, you know, within months of moving to Vienna then, Yugoslavia began to violently disintegrate. And I was the closest person to closest Wall Street Journal reporter to that area. And so that, for me, then became a commutable civil war. I mean, it was a four-hour drive from our house in Vienna to, say, the Esplanade Hotel in Zagreb, Croatia.
That's crazy.
And then Zagreb's capital, Croatia, had come under air attack, you know, at some stage.
Did you refer to it as a commutable civil war?
Yeah, because I would drive now.
Maybe the craziest statement I've ever heard. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Right. So I'd kind of throw my flak jacket in the back of the car, the back seat of the car, and drive down.
Wow.
And then, you know, both our children were born while we were in Vienna. And so that then, you know, as shortly, you know, so at that time, I'm starting to think about, yeah, this isn't kind of the reporting that I should, you know, be involved in anymore. And my wife at one stage said something eminently sensible and very wise that, you know, if you go into a place where you need a flak jacket, you probably shouldn't be going there.
That's right.
And I said, yeah, absolutely so. And so,
yeah, it should be more like, honey, do you have your lunch bag? Not, honey, do you have your flak jacket? Yeah.
Yeah. You're forgetting your lunch as opposed to, hey, do you have your flak jacket?
Yeah.
And so it was kind of, you know, at that stage then that, you know, as a foreign correspondent and somebody kind of in the midst of all that, is figuring, yeah, there's other stories that I prefer to be covering that won't necessarily put me on the front line of kind of civil wars and that kind of conflict and mayhem.
So
and the journal the editors were fine with that because they fully understood, you know, the circumstances that the various reporters will have. And so then after that, I really started writing a lot about the humanitarian and development issues. And that's then what really brings me into this topic that so moves me and kind of the passion of my journalism. Then that's basically hunger in the 21st century and the shame and absurdity, obscenity that we brought this medieval suffering with us into the 21st century, in this brand new millennium. Of ours, and you know, kind of, how dare we, and the negligence, and the unintended consequences, say, of our policies that have been perpetuating that.
So knowing that, you know, it's a great phrase, by the way, this obscenity in the 21st century that we brought into us, this medieval sort of way. You know, as a journalist, you've seen a lot. You could go on. I think I hear a positive tone in your voice. I mean, you know, is it just more of the same, Roger? You know, that whole history doomed to repeat itself kind of stuff. I mean, you just move from, you know, 4-hour communable war, winnable nuclear war, civil war, winnable nuclear war. Is it repetition?
Yeah. Well, I think repetition in the sense that kind of these threats, the conflicts, this kind of needless suffering and poverty in the world that we either seem oblivious to, or if we know about it, we don't care that much. I mean, you know, Bono has a phrase, he calls it stupid poverty.
Yes.
You know, where so many people are still dying or getting so sick in societies and being so weakened by the bite of a mosquito, you know, that hunger is still with us, even though there's certainly enough food in the world that's being produced. So basically on a caloric and energy basis, or to provide energy for everybody to live kind of a normal, active life. But it's obviously not being equitably distributed. So it's kind of still these injustices of things like hunger and poverty that remain. And, you know, you look at something like hunger, and it's kind of above all a political condition. We know how to end hunger. It's not like we're waiting for somebody in a lab coat to like discover a cure for hunger or malnutrition. No, we know what to do. But it's this political will that says, you know, finally let's do something about this. How can we live in a world of this? So in this most recent book, The First 1,000 Days, I mean, I've kind of, you know, throughout all this, that my journalistic mantra that has developed, like my mantra would be outrage and inspire. So through my reporting and writing, you know, to kind of have this 1-2 punch of outrage how have we brought all these, you know, problems and conditions with us into this 21st century, but then an inspiration that, well, there are people on the ground that are actually working towards this. The people impacted by it are recognizing and are working for it. And so, you know, the outrage that's in this First 1,000 Days book is that one in every four children in our world today is stunted. And in the developing world, it's one of every three children under the age of five is stunted, either physically, cognitively, or both at times. And the cost of that stunting to all of us and that childhood malnutrition to all of us is just such a high price that we're all kind of collectively paying for that by lower education of the children, lesser productivity because stunted children become stunted adults, lesser economic activity, the healthcare costs that are borne by individuals, by families, by societies, that rolls across time and it rolls across place. So a stunted child anywhere then becomes a stunted child everywhere, and that we've gotten to the stage of one in four children in the world are still, you know, are stunted and are malnourished, that you kind of need to smack yourself in the head and say, what's wrong with us?
Are we oblivious? I mean,
I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, when you ask, I mean, are things getting better, kind of a positive tone, you know, hopefully that kind of the awareness, you know, arises, but, you know, and kind of when you look at the overall, you know, situation of like hunger in the world, you know, in absolute numbers, you know, it's declining some, percentages just because the population keeps growing.
Sure.
Maybe declining some, but I would say that we still have this issue of one in four children in the world being stunted, of nearly a billion people being chronically hungry and malnourished, and another like 2 billion or so being micronutrient deficient, kind of a hidden hunger that you look at them and it's not like, that child's not, they're not like these horrible images that we have from famine and starvation zones of horribly emaciated children and adults, but they don't look that way. But they have this micronutrient deficiency that prevents them from having developed properly, either physically or most damaging, you know, cognitively. And, you know, that again, that we've kind of tolerated that. We have this world where that still exists.
So, as they say, it's
this obscenity. It's this
it's
shame.
It's a shame.
I'm the most conscious. And so despite all these things that have happened and progress that's being made. And in the end, look, we entered, you know, we're in this new millennium now, 16 years into it, with all this scientific and technological achievement that we have and all this communications possibilities literally at our fingertips, and still we have this situation of hunger and malnourishment to such an extent.
Well, and now you start to really see the stupidity of it, to Bono's comment, right? The extreme nature of it all. And is this, can I connect this back to unintended, as to your phrase, unintended consequences of not just U.S. foreign policy, but foreign policy in general?
Yeah, and then the domestic policy of a lot of these countries. I mean, just kind of on the hunger front, you know, agriculture development has been so long neglected. Coming up to maybe, say, in the 1980s or early 1980s, when it was still, you know, kind of seeing the impact of agriculture transformations and the Green Revolution and such. And so maybe, you know, 20-25% of overall international development aid, cumulatively, kind of from the richer countries, was 20-25% to agriculture development aspects. By 2003-2004, that was down maybe 3%, 5% or so. And then when you look at investments in nutrition, which I think, you know, people when they kind of think about it would say, oh yeah, nutrition is so fundamentally important for the development not only of individuals but of healthy, growing, strong, prosperous, stable societies in the world, that nutrition would certainly be the cornerstone of all development efforts. But still, of all the development spending that's going on, you know, less than 1% or so was being devoted to nutrition. And it's like nutrition is everywhere in both international and domestic development, and really important in the development of our, you know, countries and societies as well. So it's everywhere kind of in development, but it was nowhere in development strategies. And so, again, kind of these, you know, you think, well, what else were we emphasizing? Where else has our has the development money been spending? You know,
right.
And so in this book, The First 1,000 Days, and so what I do is I follow mom. So the 1,000 days is from when a woman becomes pregnant to the second birthday of the child, and nutrition just so critical, and the vitamins and nutrients that everybody needs. So critical for, you know, the child as he or she are growing in the womb. Well, the mom, so how the mother is eating, you know, then those nutrients then passed from mother to child, then in breastfeeding once the child is born. And as the child begins eating solid foods and the complementary feeding, then it becomes also you know, equally critical and vital for the development of the brain. And in that period, the brain is growing most expansively, most rapidly. All these, the formation of neurons and all these synapses that are happening. And that's all fueled and accelerated by good nutrition. But yet when you look at it, we have had no emphasis on nutrition. And this 1,000-day period has also been neglected by development thinkers and you know, theorists and practitioners and strategists, both kind of domestically in our own communities and then
is it the kind of thing, you know, you mentioned it's a question of political will. Obviously it's far more sort of complicated than just that, I suppose. And one of the things I've certainly learned working in development is just the interconnected nature of all these issues.
Yes.
You know, there has to be a collaborative approach, and it's got to be comprehensive,
absolutely.
And you've got to be talking to one another in the language of choice, a preferred language of choice, you know, whatever that means, depending on... I was thinking recently about a lot of political science literature just seems to presuppose that context isn't that important.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, right.
You
yeah.
know what I mean?
And
I've just done a series of interviews with filmmakers, documentarians from the Toronto International Film Festival. And for me this year, one of the themes, and I think maybe it's just a personal theme, is this notion that, wow, we just as human beings don't listen very well.
Right.
And I wonder to what degree this, you know, this problem of nutrition, malnutrition worldwide, globally, not just in the majority world, but everywhere, is a problem of people not paying attention.
Yeah, oh, very much so. And so all these moms and the children and the families that I follow through the 1,000 days in India, Uganda, Guatemala, and Chicago, that's how the narrative forms of the first 1,000 days. So it centers around the lives of these moms and children and their families and the communities in these four distinct places. And what you see is that the moms instinctively know that and practically know that these development issues, they are comprehensive, that everything is integrated.
Right.
And that so even if you, so I went into the book figured, okay, I'm going to really look at sort of the importance of nutrition and the impact of malnutrition and the cost of inaction of malnutrition, and you know, that's then I certainly see that, yeah, nutrition is fundamental and a cornerstone of all development aspects of both, as I said, individuals and families and then societies and the world as a whole. But nutrition is supported by so many other aspects of development. So water, sanitation, hygiene, infrastructure, health systems, good governance. And in the stories of all the moms and children, we see that develop through the narrative. And then also, the moms, that is, I'm going back to all these places 5-6 times in the course of 1,000 days, Chicago more frequently because it's closer.
Sure.
But, you know, then I'd spend less time perhaps at each visit with the moms of Chicago. So kind of probably cumulative. Simply the same amount with kind of everybody that I'm writing about in the book, and from them, yeah, you see this practical knowledge that you know, this all needs to come together, and these development efforts need to move forward simultaneously across a wide front. So this era that we've been in for so long of, you know, say, pet causes. Well, I do this, and I want to do that as best as possible, and I'm competing with funding against everybody else. For what I do, be it building schools or putting books in schools or building clinics or digging wells, and that's what I do. But then you can't be oblivious to everything else that's going on in those communities that you're working, because everything supports everything else. So like these moms in Uganda, they're all starting, and they're all farmers. they're starting to grow under like this Harvest Plus, so this biofortification project, which where crops are bred. Kind of traditional breeding, so there's no GMOs. It's just the breeding and highlighting traits already, nutrient traits already in those crops. So the iron that's already in beans, or the zinc that's already in wheat, the vitamin A that's already in like sweet potatoes, the orange sweet potatoes, and kind of highlighting those traits so that by eating these crops, which they eat every day, or even several meals a day, that just through eating these staple crops, they then get more nutrients.
Right.
And so the moms in Uganda, they're growing the orange flush sweet potatoes, they're growing the high iron beans. And so they realize, and they can see both themselves, how the pregnancy, kind of after they've started farming these things and consuming these crops, how they feel better during their pregnancies, how kind of the birth weights of the children are up, how the children are developing. But Brenda, one of the moms, and her boy that she gives birth to is Aaron. He's really robust and strong. Her first child, unfortunately, had died within the first 2 weeks of birth, and that was before they started growing these new crops. So here she has this robust boy born, and he's developing well. And in one trip, when I go back, I say, "So Brenda, how's Aaron doing?" And she starts having this kind of panic-stricken look on her face, and she begins weeping as she says, "He hasn't grown much since the last time you were here, which would have been, 3 or 4 months previous, and his development has stopped." I said, "Well, what happened?" And it turns out that the well that they were getting their water from had gone bad, and dysentery was spreading throughout the village.
Oh, man.
And so all her efforts on a nutrition front were undermined by a few sips of bad water. And so I'm thinking, oh, yeah, well, this is tragic that it happens in these communities. And then I'm back in the United States, and then start reading about everything going on with our water system in Flint, Michigan. And then it's not only Flint, Michigan, where the water, the heavy lead content and the problems with the water there. Then reporters are finding out, oh, there's pockets all over the United States that have troubled water sources. And it's like, wow, there are all these commonalities
around
the world in this 1,000-day period that
sure.
I just found. I found fascinating, and again, it's listening to, the moms, the families, the children on the ground of kind of what's going on in your life. And any development people, obviously, you would have found this certainly yourself. Filmmakers that are involved in reporters in these issues, that when you sit and talk to people, you kind of hear all these responses of things that are going on in their daily lives, how they make decisions,
yep.
all kinds of various forces of poverty and all the social forces that are going on, and how that all plays into the development of their children and their families and their own health, and how that then all needs to be put together in these development aspects.
How much of this is about education, not only of say, I guess you could say the moms on the ground, but of, as you say, domestic and local governments and local organizations, but also at a much higher level, I mean, I think one of the things I've certainly noticed, I teach in international development at Humber College in Toronto, and students every year come in with most of them sort of wide-eyed and want to change the world, and by the time they leave, a lot of them are quite negative and quite cynical and so on. Oh, gee, well, what are we going to do now? I mean, what a mess, How the heck are we, where do we even begin, kind of a thing? And so, and yet, even still, going into some of these settings with, we've got the answers, here's what it says, or here's the chart, or here's the log frame that we're going to use that's going to make all the difference in the world. And the reality is, everything can change once you're on the ground. So I think it's about education sort of at all levels, but if that's true, how do you inject that, into the conversation?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and it's, yeah, certainly. I mean, so education is absolutely critical and a critical part of kind of all these programs, that you may initiate or put on the ground in development aspects of all societies. And I found that, like, in speaking with the moms during their pregnancies, that probably the most common craving of pregnant women around the world is for knowledge, and particularly knowledge on the nutrition front. Well, what should I be doing, or what should I be eating?
Right.
Even whether it's their first child or their second, third, fourth, fifth child, it's like, well, what's new? What should I be eating? Where's that information there? And then you find that when they get the information, and so in each of the four places that I'm at, there's local organizations, you know, development workers, social workers that are working, you know, with the moms. And so they're kind of departing this information. And so, and again, you see, gee, this nutritional information is the same all over the world. You know, it's based, these nutrients are the you know, humanity's common denominator, that we all know them. And so then you can see the moms, they're taking notes. They're paying attention on the foods to eat, how to cook the foods. Basic information that we would think is like kind of really basic or no-brainer type of things, but it becomes revolutionary when you're hearing these things for the first time. And so, yeah, we see that, and you know, the phrase then, knowledge is power. And so there's this empowerment that comes with the knowledge, but then when you're faced with, because of various, you know, limitations in society or because of the family's own poverty, that the inability then to put this knowledge into play, this knowledge is not so much power then as that knowledge becomes a burden. It's another thing that the moms know and the families know, yes, this is what we're supposed to do, but, well, we can't afford this food. Or, you know, you're on the south side of Chicago where going to a farmer's market or going to a shopping center or a grocery store, you know, might be a fairly hazardous prospect in these times, in certainly during the times of escalating violence in parts of the south side of Chicago. So you see that then becomes these kind of limiting factors. So poverty then becomes this trump card of everything. Mm. And so, you know, addressing the underlying issues of poverty and the injustices and imbalances that causes then also needs to be kind of part of all development aspects, whether they be in our cities or our rural areas, you know, in Canada and the United States and the rich precincts of the world, or whether it's kind of development aspects for people in countries and in the developing world. And so, and then the education, so not only the moms, but as you say, from the top down, that you need to get to the heads of state, to the finance ministers who control the budget. So it was really interesting. So 2 weeks ago, when the World Bank held their annual fall meetings in Washington, Jim Kim, the head of the World Bank, he basically summoned all the finance ministers to a session that lasted for about 2 hours or so, where he and then others were talking about the importance of nutrition in the first 1,000 days. And what they were then talking about is this value of what they're calling gray matter infrastructure investment. So investing in the development of the brain, gray matter, because the World Bank and these finance ministers of all of these countries, they've all been focused on for decades, what we need is developing countries. We need investments in roads and bridges and airports and dams and buildings. And as well, now they're saying and realizing, hey, one thing we've been forgotten about and neglecting in all this is perhaps the most crucial investment in all, and that's the investment in particularly the cognitive development of our children.
So how do you go after a leader like that? So you're talking about, you know, you talked about the cost of stunting, right? So you got productivity and education and healthcare costs and economic, and so. But what about the use the word obscenity, right? Very values laden. What about the moral question? You know,
and that's a really important question. So, you know, for years, that's been the primary argument. This is a moral issue. It's an issue of decency, of humanity.
Right.
We have to end hunger. We have to end malnutrition. And clearly, that hasn't moved us far enough that we still have these problems with us. So part of this argument now, that when you go to the finance ministry, you look at the cost of malnutrition, the cost of inaction, and so with this kind of rising kind of 1,000 days movement in around the world, and say also in the United States, there's this parallel movement that's been going on called Scaling Up Nutrition, and now it's about 60 countries that are kind of members of that. These countries are starting to do economic analysis in their own countries of the cost of childhood malnutrition and stunting, and what they're finding is really eye opening for them and kind of for the rest of us. Is that so? In countries like, you know, India, Uganda, Guatemala, where, you know, the childhood malnutrition and stunting rates, you know, are 30, 40, 50% of the child population, Those costs, those annual costs to the economy are the equivalent of 6, 8, 10% equivalent of GDP loss every wow. year because of the lost education, the lost productivity, the accumulated health care costs throughout society. Ethiopia did an analysis, and it was 16%. And then there's kind of then regional analysis goes on. Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, cumulative in both cases, the impact of childhood malnutrition and stunting is estimated to be an annual cost of about 11% of GDP equivalency. 11%.
Wow.
So when you start, so that then becomes part of the education of the finance ministers,
sure.
The presidents, the prime ministers, the ministers of economic development, those that are looking at the competitiveness of their countries and societies and for outside investment and things, and they're also internal investment, look at the cost that this is having. Yes, it's always been the right thing to invest in these issues and make sure you don't have any malnourished and hungry children in your countries. It's always been the right thing to do, but now it becomes the smart thing to do. If your countries want to advance, to grow economically, to have opportunities for all, to move into middle-income countries, then you've really got to concentrate on this. So I think that then becomes the next step of this, that, you know, yes, it's always been a moral and humanitarian issue. It's always been the right thing to do, but now it becomes the smart thing and the vital thing to do for the not only the health and development of the children and families, but for, you know, our own economies. And then globally, you know, so the World Bank will estimate it might be 3 to 4%, $7 trillion a year of global cost of childhood malnutrition and stunting.
So I'm going to play the idealistic card and just go, there's something about that pisses me off, Roger, that it's got to mm-hmm. be an economic
right.
reason that's going to motivate the world to action.
Right.
There really is. I mean, you know, right. you quoted Bono, I'll quote him as well. I mean, I'm pretty sure he said this isn't, or at least it's a variation of somebody else, but this isn't about charity, it's about justice. Well, if it's really if the question is really about justice, there's got to be some kind of moral linkling there. There's got to be some kind of, you know, ethical edge to that that says this is just plain wrong. This is obscene.
Right.
This is beyond reproach. You know, the gap continues to grow, and what the heck are we doing about it? You know, and I think for me, from a social change perspective, you know, you used the word unintended consequences, and I was gonna ask you about the whole splash and ripple and the incrementalism of it all, and you know, the little baby steps and so on. And I mean, I wonder, you know, obviously, I think we are moving in the right direction. I just kind of sometimes wish, when it comes to these issues, wish is the wrong word, but would like to think that we can do so much better.
Right.
Without that much effort, for crying out loud.
Exactly. And that's the underlying thing of this. I mean, we can do much better. And when you look at it, well, what are we doing to all of us and to ourselves? And so I write in the book, I mean, there's all the, you know, so there's all this economic analysis going on, and the numbers are like big, and, you know, staggering. Gee, you know, and you ask yourself, well, why do some places of the world remain poor? Both places abroad, but in places in our own countries and societies, why do they remain so poor and kind of mired in poverty? It's largely because their children are getting off to such a lousy start in life.
Interesting.
And then you figure that kind of the economic impact, and there are huge numbers, as I said. But to me, the greatest cost of malnutrition and stunting, that they're immeasurable. You know, it's like something that would benefit all of us. Like, it's a song not sung, or a novel not imagined, or a poem not written. You know, an invention not discovered, or a building not designed, or a horizon not explored. You know, an innovation not nurtured, a cure not discovered. So what might a child have contributed to the world if he or she hadn't been stunted in 1,000 days? Look, a lost chance at greatness for one is a lost chance for all of us. And so we would hope that everybody should be moved by this moral outrage that has to happen. So this outrage and this inspiration that we're outraged about, certainly we can do something about it.
Sure.
And there's various inspirations that we can do something, particularly about this issue of hunger and malnutrition. But that clearly hasn't moved us collectively enough to get to where we need to be on this, because we still have, as I said, this obscenity and this stain on our conscience of hunger and malnutrition and childhood stunting. And if that hasn't moved us, and then the whole argument then also moved, it got a security aspect
sure,
to it. That,
sure.
That, look, if the moral issues don't, reasoning doesn't move you, and my God, it should, but if it's not for some strange reason, look at all these social, these security aspects of it. What kind of unstable world are we in where there are such great injustices and inequalities and that some people are still afflicted with this medieval suffering? So what kind of stable society and world is that?
Yeah, doesn't Jeffrey Sachs...
That doesn't move you.
The end of poverty,
basically.
Right,
and if that doesn't move you, here's these economic reasons, and what are we losing? What benefits are we not reaping potentially from all these children because they're stunted and they got off to a lousy start in life?
Yeah. Without a doubt. I mean, and we're kind of back to that whole interconnected comment and how mm-hmm. it's all kind of a smaller piece of a much larger puzzle. Doesn't Sachs say in The End of Poverty that, you know, his answer for people, well, why in part? Well, because of terrorism and violence, essentially. I mean, I think that's one of his points that he makes in his
right.
book.
Right. Yeah, because that's if you're in one of these situations and somebody comes, you know, with you for argument, hey, join this organization or let's do this, and you're kind of in this hopeless situation, and you may be exposed and you're seeing injustice, well, why am I in this situation? That then becomes, in essence, I think that he talks about, you know, also this kind of the siren song.
Sure.
You know, and that then became like after 9/11 and kind of all the terrorism that we've seen, the burst of terrorism since then, that, you know, how much of this is driven, or the recruitment of people and this ideology spreads, you know, kind of, you know, along with these inequalities and injustices in our world.
So the book, so we're going to have to wrap it up here in a few minutes, Roger, sadly, but the book is The First 1,000 Days, A Crucial Time for Mothers and Children and the World. So you spend a lot of time laying it out and the research and the studies of these four women and their families, no doubt. Do you get into solutions at all? Do you talk about the policymakers, the domestic and foreign, and the people on the ground, and what they might be able to do?
Yes, very much so. So as one is seen, so they kind of the opening, the prologue of the book then kind of has this bigger picture thing and the statistics and this,
sure.
this economic rationale and argument. But then starting with chapter one, I mean, it's all about, it's the narrative flow of the moms and the children and the families in each of these four places, and then, you know, with them as one observes them, then it's also, well, here's what kind of these local organizations or international organizations are kind of doing on the ground, on the education aspect, on the healthcare aspect, on issues of governance, on issues of kind of behavior change, you know, and communications of these things, and here's organizations that are then trying to move things forward on a wider front simultaneously. And so hopefully that's where one then, you know, you have kind of the outrage of 1 in 4 children malnourished or stunted in our world. But then, you know, here we can see things moving on the ground and where ideas, you know, can happen. And still, even where progress is being made, then still undermined at times by this uneven development or focusing on one cause and not another. And then on the issue of governance, I mean, when Cesar really clearly say in Guatemala, at the beginning of the 1,000 days when I'm following the moms, you know, the government, they're reasonably new in office, and they're saying they have, you know, targets to reduce stunting by 10%. And Guatemala has almost 50% nationwide stunting rates in Guatemala. It's the worst in the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And in the Western Highlands, where I'm following the moms and their children, it's upwards of 70% of childhood malnutrition and stunting. So that government is saying, oh, for the sake of our competitiveness and just the sheer humanity of it all, we need to attack stunting and malnutrition. They set targets for like a reduction of 10% in 4 years, which would be, you know, ambitious. And then by the time the 1,000 days is finished and I'm following the moms in the Western Highlands, how are they impacted by all this and by what the government's saying and, you know, whatever programs there are? By the time of my reporting, the leaders of the government are out of office. Some of them are in jail. There's been a corruption
right.
Thing. And all these efforts are basically, you know, kind of washed away by all this, by the corruption and the scandals and everything that, and in fact, then some of that then, you know, is like, well, this government really, you know, tries, you know, reducing malnutrition, or at least rhetorically. Well, where did that get them? You know, they kind of end up in this, in out of office and discredited for other actions, not on the nutrition front. So it's like, that issue. So do we want to try that again? The new government is starting to emphasize malnutrition and reducing stunting again. But you see there the crucial nature of it has to have the support of the government.
Sure.
Because
yeah.
These moms, when the children were coming to the one to the age of one and getting their one year old vaccines, there weren't even any vaccines available in these areas, in the clinics and in the hospitals, and a lot of the local clinics were being shut down because there was no money in the system. The health budget had been the health ministry budget had been pillaged, and it's like, wow. So all this rhetoric is just so hollow because, again, listening to the moms and the families on the ground, what's actually happening? What are we getting out of all this rhetoric and talk? Nothing's happening here. Mm-hmm. In fact, things are actually getting worse. And so, you know, that through the narrative of this, you start to see, hopefully what the reader sees, yeah, these are important initiatives that are happening. We can see how, you know, this agriculture that emphasizes nutrition, how that's important, the nutritious value of the crops, how kind of behavior change and behavior change communications is important in altering some practices. Like even the United States and the addiction to moms have of these flaming hot Cheetos and these snack foods and stuff that are you know, not good at all for their health, realizing to eat healthy. It's kind of all these changes that have to happen. So you see kind of, yeah, what needs to be done and what is being done. And then also then how still kind of holes and troubles with healthcare systems and, you know, infrastructure and things and kind of constantly still undermines those things. So hopefully one becomes really aware of, here's what is being done. Here's some, you know, there's the outrage and the inspiration.
Sure.
And still what needs to be done. And this kind of integrative, comprehensive development method that we got to do it all simultaneously. And as you say, so critical. You just have to listen to people on the ground because these moms, these families, they're living it daily. They know it instinctively, you know, what needs to go on. And we just need to really listen to them.
Sort of a, here's the reality and here's our response.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So you mentioned really quickly. You mentioned campaigns. You mentioned was it the 1,000 Days campaign?
Or movement, I guess. So there's an organization called. Yeah, there's like the 1,000 Days organization in Washington D.C. that is, you know, kind of coordinating. The awareness raising, the communications, and the need for the.
Yeah, that's 1000days.org, is it not?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So this is a good way for people to get involved. There's a lot of information there. You can donate. You can read more. You can dig.
Exactly. And, you know, I think what we all need, what's incumbent on all of us, people are thinking, so what can I do?
Yeah.
It's to really I'm always saying, you know, raise the clamor on these things.
Mm, nice.
And say, this is why it's important, the 1,000 days. This is the cost of our inaction and what we're all bearing. But that you know, we can do something about it and raise the clamor that basically, I mean, my hope would be that the 1,000 days, or the phrase, the first 1,000 days, then becomes this household word, this household phrase.
Sure.
All over the world, that in Canada, in the United States, in Europe, and throughout the developing world, that when you hear the phrase, the first 1,000 days, you don't need an explanation. You know immediately what time frame it is, what the important issues are, and why it's so important.
Sure.
for all of us. And so it becomes kind of the new kind of cornerstone or paradigm, I guess, that one is a prism that one is looking at all development efforts through, that what are we doing that really then improves nutrition, water, sanitation, hygiene, infrastructure, everything, governance, in that's really improving the conditions in that 1,000-day period.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. Roger Thurow, he's a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. His book, The First 1,000 Days, A Crucial Time for Mothers and Children and the World, it's available on Amazon. and check the organization 1000days.org online out as well for more information about how you can get involved. Roger, thanks for your time and for your work. I want to say congratulations. And you were just up here recently, and I'm so sorry I missed you and up here in Ontario. And hopefully we'll get to meet sometime in the near future. But, yeah, so appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, thank you. I'd be delighted to come back, because I found a lot of interest and excitement around this issue, and a lot of caring and fellow travelers who also want to. I don't know if that's a proper phrase.
No, sir. No, it's fine. But, hey, I know what the question.
But comrades in the struggle who will also raise a comrades too. Compatriots in the struggle that will also raise the clamor.
And I think next time we chat, I want to find out what the final word on Kraft dinner is. I think I need to know.
Oh, right. Okay. I can do that.
Excellent. Roger, thanks a lot for your time again today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And delighted to share this time with you and your listeners.
Thanks.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.